In our third case this morning, we are welcoming Judge Lisa Forbes from the 8th District Court of Appeals to sit in place of Justice Bruner this morning. Judge Forbes, thank you for serving.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
This is 2022-0169 in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Damon Taylor. On behalf of the appellant, first arguing, Mr. Gilbert. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'll be reserving 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll be sharing 3 minutes of my initial time with Mr. Hendershot of the Solicitor General's office. I'll start with the jurisdictional bindover issues. After a juvenile court bindover, the adult court under 21-51-23H has jurisdiction over the case as if the case had initially commenced in that court. The only exception under Smith and now Senate Bill 288 is that any count for which the juvenile court found was unsupported by probable cause stays behind and remains within the exclusive jurisdiction of the juvenile court. Otherwise, the adult court's authority to adjudicate particular counts in the indictment goes not to subject matter jurisdiction, but to jurisdiction over the case, and any objections to particular counts in the indictment have to be preserved for appeal. Here, the defense raised no objections to the indictment, but ultimately the adult court committed no error, let alone plain error, in convicting the defendant of felony murder. This is because the juvenile court found probable cause for complicity to purposeful murder, and felony murder, predicated on felonious assault, is rooted in that offense under the standards set forth in Burns and Smith.
Excuse me, counsel, could the state have just simply presented an account of felony murder at the juvenile proceeding?
They could have, but
why wouldn't they? They had the evidence that supported it.
They weren't required to, Your Honor, and there's nothing unusual about the state presenting certain counts at the juvenile bindover proceeding, particularly jurisdictionally dispositive counts, as purposeful murder would be. There's an allegation that in the briefing that this would create an incentive for gamesmanship, and I have to disagree with that. Again, the purpose of a bindover hearing is not to be some final be-all, end-all adjudication of guilt or innocence. It's only to determine jurisdiction. So it makes perfect sense that only jurisdictionally dispositive counts would be focused at the bindover hearing. And then under 21-51-23H, that statute would then allow the court, the adult court, to adjudicate counts that are not transferred as part of the case under the bindover proceedings, which would include any count rooted in an offense that was bound over. And in this case, the felony murder count predicated on felonious assault easily satisfies the rooted in standard because it's based on the exact same conduct as the purposeful murder count. And it is immaterial that the juvenile court found probable cause based on complicity rather than principal offense, because under 29-2303F, which is the specific statute governing complicity, a complicitor shall be prosecuted as the principal offender, and a charge of complicity may be stated in terms of the principal offense. So the juvenile court's distinction between complicity and the principal offense did not bar the adult court from exercising jurisdiction over a felony murder count predicated on felonious assault, even if it's stated as a principal offense in the indictment. Ultimately, the adult court instructed the jury on both principal offense and complicity, and the verdict forms don't make any distinction, but they weren't required to under this court's cases. So at the end of the day, the felony murder count easily satisfies the standard in Burns and Smith and 21-51-23H, and that it is rooted in the bound over offense. I want to say a brief word about Senate Bill 288 and why that bill does not overrule or supersede Burns. First off, let me preface my comment by saying that the adult court's jurisdiction after a bindover consists of two components. First, you have the case that is actually transferred by the juvenile court. And then after the case is transferred, 21-51-23H gives the adult court post-transfer jurisdiction to adjudicate counts that are not included within the case. And all Senate Bill 288 did was define the case to exclude any counts for which the juvenile court specifically found that probable cause was absent. The bill did not change 2151.23H in that it did not eliminate or amend or otherwise affect the language of that statute that gives the adult court jurisdiction after the transfer of the case to adjudicate counts that are rooted in a bound over offense.
So I understand the rooted in language is in our opinion, but where does that come from in the text of the statute?
It doesn't.
It's just something made up?
Well, the statute just refers to any count different from the offense charged. So if you're going strictly on the statutory text, then the adult court could exercise jurisdiction over any count, whether or not it's rooted in, the exception being after Senate Bill 288, if the juvenile court specifically found that a count was unsupported by probable cause, that count would be off the table in adult court.
So I mean, does it, under the language of the statute, does it even have to be something that arises out of the same offense?
If you're looking strictly at the statutory language, the answer is no. But we do have Smith and we do have Burns, and so we're arguing.
Why aren't you asking us to overturn those decisions?
We don't have to, Your Honor. If your court is inclined to address the rooted in standard and say that there's not even a rooted in requirement at all, we wouldn't object to that. We win under the rooted in standard anyway.
Wouldn't that be going against the intent of the legislature if they just passed a bill that incorporated Smith?
But again, Smith involves what is transferred by the juvenile court. It doesn't involve the juvenile court's post-transfer jurisdiction.
And but it said if you don't establish probable cause on one of those counts, that doesn't go over with the case.
But if the count was never adjudicated at all in juvenile court, then it's not part of the case, and Smith and Burns and 2151.23H would allow the court to exercise post-transfer jurisdiction over a count that was never adjudicated at all in juvenile court. Justice DeWine, we would not object to the court discarding the rooted in standard and allowing the adult court to have jurisdiction over any offense subject to Senate Bill 288, but we would win under the rooted in standard anyway. Moving on to the Sixth Amendment issues, unless the court has any questions about the bindover issues, I'll just say that I agree with the 10th District that the Sixth Amendment issue operates, the Sixth Amendment framework is three basic questions. You have attachment, you have assertion, and you have waiver. Those are the three basic questions. Now, to affirm the 10th District, you would have to rule in the defendant's favor on all three legal issues. To reverse the 10th District, we only have to win on any of the three issues, and in fact, we should win on all three, because the Court of Appeals made legal errors regarding all three issues regarding attachment, assertion, and waiver. And this is not a case of the Court of Appeals simply misapplying well-settled law to a particular fact pattern. This is a situation where the Court of Appeals is inventing legal standards that are going to cause confusion regarding post-arrest, pre-charge interrogations, particularly on the issue of what police officers are obligated to do under the Sixth Amendment in those interrogations.
Well, doesn't it seem problematic if the police can decide to press charges against someone, not file those charges, bring the person in, interrogate them, and then file those charges after they're done with the interrogation? Well, I mean, what if that became a standard police practice?
I mean,
if we decide this case your way, wouldn't that be what the police would decide to do?
Well, Justice DeWine, I think that happens in police stations all across the country every day. Police arrest a suspect, they're bringing him to the station, they issue him Miranda warnings. The Miranda warnings give ample protection to the suspect to make sure he doesn't give any compelled statements. And then after the interrogation, they file the charge. There's some talk in the briefing about 2935.05 and how there can't be an undue delay between a warrantless arrest and presenting the charge to a court. We don't have any undue delay here under this court's cases, and even if we did, that would not be basis to suppress the statements. I just want to emphasize before I turn my time over to Mr. Hendershot that the trial court made a finding that the Miranda waiver was knowing and intelligent, and the 10th District agreed with that finding. That should have ended the analysis under the Sixth Amendment. But instead, the 10th District invented this new test under the Sixth Amendment that required the detectives, because the defendant had counsel at some point and maybe still had counsel on December 12th, the detectives were constitutionally obligated to contact counsel so that the defendant could consult with counsel in deciding whether to waive counsel. And that is flatly inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Monteo and particularly in Moran versus Burbine as well.
Well, let me ask, Counselor, so when the lawyer says, my client doesn't want to make any statement, don't contact my client, contact my client through me, how long for a period of time before a law enforcement officer can do so? I mean,
well, I don't know that that counts as an invocation at all, because both the right to counsel under the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment are personal rights that belong only to the defendant. A lawyer cannot invoke.
So you say, so in this case, of course, so the defendant can always say, my lawyer said. So in other words, you're saying it really doesn't matter what the lawyer says to anybody.
Right. Now, I will say the defendant himself invoked his right to counsel under Miranda during the April interrogation.
Right.
And under Edwards versus Arizona, that would have precluded any further police questioning, even with
For how long?
14 days, as long as there's a break in custody. That would be the Schatzer case. Once there's a break in custody, there's no longer, of 14 days or more, there'd be no longer any presumption of coerciveness that would apply under Edwards versus Arizona. But here we have an 8-month-long break of custody. So I dispute that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel had even attached, and I dispute whether whatever the lawyer said or the defendant said in April or in the intervening months qualify as a legal assertion of the right to counsel. But even putting those issues aside, we have the trial court and the 10th District finding that the defendant knowingly and voluntarily waived his Miranda rights. And under Monteo, that should have been dispositive on the Sixth Amendment question as well. I'll yield the rest of my initial time to Mr. Hendershot. Thank you.
Mr. Hendershot, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the Court, I'd like to begin with Justice DeWine's question about, would reversing the 10th District's decision here about the Sixth Amendment, would that change police practice? And I think if you take a look at Montejo versus Louisiana, that's a 2009 U.S. Supreme Court case, it deals with, I think, all of the Sixth Amendment topics in this case, including that one. And what the court did there in cutting back and overruling one of its own precedents about a Fifth and Sixth Amendment prophylaxis would say, all the protection that exists because of the Miranda warnings is sufficient in these circumstances, and so you don't need an additional prophylaxis, and that's why they overruled one of their own cases that continued to stack these additional presumptions on top of additional presumptions. Now, if I could back up then and talk about our other two propositions of law together, that's about the transfer over to the general division, as well as the nature of the jurisdiction that is transferred there. I think now with the new statute, with the Senate Bill 288 change to the statute, the legislature has defined both what is transferred over and the consequence once a case is transferred over. So here, the existing 2151.12H defines the scope of a case once it is transferred. Think of it like supplemental jurisdiction in federal courts. You have a properly transferred case. Now the question is, what is the scope of it? That language, which was interpreted unanimously and recently in Burns, remains unchanged, and it says there can be additional charges. Taylor, on page 11 of his brief, says he admits he could be convicted of charges different from those in the juvenile court. I think that's dispositive, whether it's under Burns or whether, as Justice DeWine asked, whether you think about that exclusively through the new statute in 288 and the existing statute.
So if we're just going by the text of the statute, is there any basis for this rooted in idea?
I think that comes from Smith, rather from the statute, and now that the legislature has codified one part of what Smith did, I don't think the rooted in traces back to the statute. I think it is case law gloss on the previous 2151.12H.
If we just applied the plain language of 2153.23H, would that mean that grand jury could indict someone for any offense once they've been transferred, as long as the case has been transferred?
I think any offense that's not taken back by the new amendment in Senate Bill 280,
correct. Any offense for which there has not been a finding of no probable cause.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And that, I don't think that should be concerning or any concern with gamesmanship, as Mr. Gilbert said. I mean, you still have the grand jury process and all the protections that proceed in the general division.
I mean, so I'm trying to understand how practically this is going to work. If you have cases that stay, I mean, you could have, say, a lesser included offense that stays in juvenile court and something else that gets, well, maybe not lesser included, but you could have, closely related offenses that's been tried in two different courts. Is that going to cause any problems? Are there double jeopardy issues that could arise?
Well, I guess I'm relieved not to be in the trenches in juvenile court dealing with those issues. I'm afraid that that new statute is going to cause new issues that I'm sure will bring cases to you all in the future. Because this case is straightforward, whether it's even including that new language, because you have a finding of probable cause to complicity, you have a jury conviction that's complicity and or principal offense. I see I'm starting to invade my own time and Mr. Gilbert's, so if there are no other questions, I would ask that you reverse the 10th District across the board.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gatterdam, good morning.
Good morning. Chief Justice Kennedy, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Court Gatterdam, and myself and Tim Hackett represent Damon Taylor. I'll be handling the right to counsel issue. The right to counsel as to juveniles flows through the due process clause. This court has said that in CS and has said that it is more malleable than rigid. So I would ask you in considering this assignment of error to consider that in this particular case, the quote from the detective on the date of December 12, 2016 is, "I'm not lying. We did write this up. It is your charge, and as you see from it, it is for murder." When asked at the suppression hearing, he said, "Yes, I arrested him and charged him with murder." So the first part that the prosecution talked to you about, attachment of the right to counsel, oh, it attached, because he was charged with murder.
But in fairness, he wasn't charged with murder. The charges weren't filed till afterwards.
He notified him, and the tape shows him pointing to something like, "See, I have the charge." I don't believe that the actual physical filing, it happens at 9:21 p.m. I'm not sure that the clerk's office would even be open then for filing. So we can't get into this whole situation where we have to determine when the clerk actually got it and decided to file it, or when the prosecutor sent the detective over there. In this case, I'd ask you to rely back on Kirby. And it's the commitment to prosecute is what the U.S. Supreme Court said. And Moran versus Burbine, it said when it...
But that's not the standard the United States Supreme Court follows in these cases. It's not when they decide to prosecute. It's when formal charges are instituted.
But I would admit, I would say that they are, and especially, again, going back to due process for juveniles. Juveniles, historically, brains not developed, inability to make correct decisions. In that particular case, when you say you're charged, you're charged. You need an attorney at that moment. They've committed themselves to prosecute this man, and he needs an attorney.
Even assuming that you're right on that, I mean, he was still told he had a right to an attorney, and he waived that right.
He waived that right. That goes to the voluntary, knowing, and intelligent prong of this, which I would say you can't look at it in a vacuum. You have to go back to April when this all started, and he invoked his right to counsel.
But I'm not sure that helps you, though, right? Because he had a relationship with an attorney. He knew he could get one if he wanted to, and he chose not to.
Did he? Because what happened when he invoked last time is they said, "Oh, counsel's not going to help you," and they kept questioning him. Yes, did he get a counsel? He sure did. And that counsel spent 8 months going back and forth with the prosecution and with the detective. And what did they do? Did they give him the courtesy of a call? Did they say, "Hey, Damon, do you want your attorney who we've been dealing with for 8 months?
And that would have maybe been nice or appropriate, but was it required?
It is required, because especially for juvenile defendants whose, again, I keep going back to this court's language in CS. They need counsel more so than an adult in this situation.
What?
But I want to go back to what Justice DeWine was asking about. I didn't understand that part of your argument that he had counsel, invoked it in April, had it for 8 months. December, he's asked, does he want counsel? He says no.
I just don't think it's that cut and dried. I think you look at what happened here. He was told in April, you're a person of interest in this, okay? So then he says, I want a lawyer and I want my mother.
Right.
Well, a lawyer's not going to help you. And they keep questioning him. So what happens after that? Then they say, you know what? We may charge your mother and we may charge your sister. And that comes up again in December. And again, that's why, whether this is a voluntary waiver, how can it be? I invoked my right to counsel in April, and they kept questioning me. Now they're back in December. Where's Jeremy? And should he have said something? But he's faced with being told, you're going to get charged with murder.
But he wasn't told that the second time in December.
In December, he was told you were charged with murder, and he was told that we may charge your mother.
Right, but he wasn't told we're going to continue to question you. And they didn't. They could have. I mean, they did because he said no.
He
didn't want a lawyer.
In December, they did continue to question.
Right, because he said okay.
But they didn't. They ignored the. They made an end run around counsel. Would he have said no if his counsel were there? His counsel had already told them. What point is it of counsel to call and say, "Hey, I'm his lawyer. I'll turn him in if you're going to charge him." But if you're going to want to talk to him, the answer is no. You can't talk to him. Doesn't that mean something? I mean, I realize the prosecutors argued it's a personal right, and he gets it. But we're just basically saying juveniles, we don't care. It doesn't matter. If you invoked without, if the police officer had said, well, maybe, you know, is Jeremy still your lawyer? Do you want to give Jeremy a call? We might have a different fact pattern, but I don't see how this is a voluntary waiver. It's certainly not an intelligent waiver. You're being charged with murder. Just go ahead and confess to it. I mean, we deserve more when dealing with youth and the due process clause. That's what sets this aside. The right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment is one thing, but when you're dealing with juveniles, it flows through the due process clause.
So you keep referring back to dealing with juveniles. But in December, Mr. Taylor was not a juvenile any longer.
Correct.
Should we consider him a juvenile because he committed the crime when he was a juvenile? Or,
yes.
Or do we consider the time at which he is waiving his right or attempting to waive his right, what his status is?
My argument is that you consider when the crime occurred and he was a juvenile, and what court is he subject to jurisdictional-wise for that offense when that happened? And that's the juvenile court. And that's why I would argue under either analysis, the Sixth Amendment analysis, or the due process analysis, the Court of Appeals should be affirmed because this is not a knowing, voluntary, or intelligent waiver under the totality of the circumstances. But I think you have to consider his age at the time of the crime. So again, it's very clear that the state was proceeding. They had made it very clear to everybody except Damon Taylor and his attorney. So when they came, and I think Justice DeWine, you raised the issue, and I think it's true. If we say that the right to counsel doesn't start until the actual physical filing, what's to stop them from saying, you know what, we've got a lot of evidence, but let's try to get a confession out of this guy. Don't file the complaint. Hold off. Is that really what we want for any criminal defendant, or certainly for juveniles? Is that the policy that we want to set forth? It makes no sense to argue that's a fair way to go. And that's why we had argued this court doesn't even need to consider this issue, because it's so fact-specific. All these other cases cited by the prosecution don't address the issue of an existing attorney-client relationship and 8 months dealing with the prosecution. That's what set the and the lead detective. I mean, they're going back and forth a couple months before. And the cavalier attitude of this detective at the suppression hearing should not be something that should be affirmed. Sitting there and saying, I didn't care whether he had counsel or not. I wasn't exactly sure. Well, you were dealing with him for 8 months. You were sure. And so this is the policy that and the Court of Appeals said, no, we're gonna look at the totality of the circumstances in this case under these facts, and we find it is not a valid waiver. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll cede the rest of my time to Mr. Hackett.
Good morning, Mr. Hackett.
May it please the court. There are two glaring problems with this state's appeal regarding the first three propositions of law. The first is that not one of them are justiciable. Each presents in turn an advisory, a moot, or an unpreserved question. The second is that even if they were, the General Assembly has since decided that Revised Code Section 2152.022, that has not come up in the state's argument at all. 2152.022 governs, quote, the determination of jurisdiction after the transfer. That's what 2151.23H says in the very next sentence. The state's entire argument rests on the preceding sentence. The very next sentence says the determination of jurisdiction after transfer is determined by 2152.022. And what does that statute say? It says that the case that is transferred consists of the charges originally brought in juvenile court and for which probable cause was found. The legislature has resolved this dispute by adopting this court's original decision in Smith. The plain language of the intervening statute and principles of judicial restraint and respect for that legislature's judgment all require that this court dismiss this case. Now, briefly on the prudential concerns, the first proposition calls for an unconstitutional.
Let me go back there. Why not? I mean, isn't the statute as written perfectly consistent with Smith? The case is what transfers, but the prosecutor can bring the state can bring new charges whether the conviction for the commission of a lesser included offense or for the commission of another offense that is different from the offense charged.
So Smith did not include the rooted in exception. That came from Burns, and it's our proposition and position that Burns was abrogated by these amendments because
the legislature didn't repeal that part of 2153.23H. Why not just apply the plain language?
Instead of repealing it, they included the very next sentence, which says the determination of jurisdiction after transfer is determined by 0.022, which defines case, as Smith originally did, not Burns. And to answer Your Honor's question perhaps more directly, is that the preceding sentence in H, as this court addressed in Smith, refers not to charges of indictment, but the charges of conviction. There's a paragraph in Smith that discusses and addresses this and explains that that sentence in H is defense protective. It simply tells an adult court that cases may be resolved in the same way as any other case originally brought before it that ends in different charges than those originally brought, meaning through a lesser included instruction if it goes to jury or by plea negotiation. So it's really defense protective, and then now with the amended statute, the very next sentence again defines case. The case that is transferred consists of those charges originally brought in juvenile court and for which probable cause was found. And, you know, the timing of all this kind of confuses everything, but ironically, I think the amended statute addresses the concerns raised by Chief Justice Kennedy in her dissent in Smith, because at that time, the legislature had not defined case. And so that was a point of contention at the time that Smith was argued and decided. There was no definition of case. The legislature then stepped in, defined case in the case that is transferred, despite leaving the different than language in. But as I mentioned, the Smith decision already explained that that language is really defense protective and refers not to charges of indictment, but rather ultimately charges of conviction. And so it's our position, Your Honors, that Burns really. Burns created this rooted in exception that is found nowhere in the language of the statute, but the intervening amendments abrogated Burns's rooted in exception. And so the decision below, at the end of the day, it was correct under Smith, which was the only decision that the 10th District Court of Appeals had the benefit of at the time the case was decided, and it's now correct under the intervening statutes. And so that's why I mentioned at the outset of our argument that the second proposition, and really this whole case, is moot because Burns was abrogated and the decision was correct under current law. Touching very briefly, as my time expires here, on the third proposition regarding subject matter jurisdiction, I just want to submit to the court that I think this proposition presents a radical one of profound implications. That was not squarely presented as a standalone question or ruled upon by the 10th District below. Rather, it was asserted by the state as an unsupported premise to their waiver argument. The state did not raise to the 10th District this sweeping proposition that this has nothing to do with subject matter jurisdiction, and surely the 10th District did not issue a ruling on that proposition either, which is why I submit to the court that not one of the state's first three propositions are squarely or properly before this court, and why this case should be dismissed. As there are no further questions, I appreciate the court's time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Mr. Gilbert, your time is up, but I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the bindover issues, the case is not moot. I disagree with the defense that .022 governs post-transfer jurisdiction. You guys can read the statute for yourself, but that statute only defines what the case is. Post-transfer jurisdiction is still governed by .23H. Senate Bill 288 did not change the language in .23.
So what do we do with this language? And it says Section 2152.02 of the revised code applies with respect to the transfer case for criminal prosecutions described in this division and the determination of jurisdiction after the transfer.
It determines the jurisdiction after the transfer of the adult court's jurisdiction of the case. Again, the adult court's jurisdiction consists of two components. It consists of the case.
And how does it define the case?
It defines the case as any count for which the juvenile court found probable cause, but not any count for which the juvenile court found probable cause was absent. But .23H is still good law, and it still allows the adult court to exercise jurisdiction beyond the case to include counts that are not included in the case. And under the rooted in standard in Smith and in Burns, the felony murder count is easily rooted in the bound over offense. And by the way, the rooted in standard does come from Smith. That is not Burns is not the first time the rooted in standard appears. It appears in, I think, paragraph 34 or 35 of the Smith decision. As for the jurisdictional issue, the state raised that jurisdictional in the supplemental brief in the 10th District. You can see that in the record. And on the Sixth Amendment question, I'll just note that, again, the trial court made a finding that the waiver was knowing and voluntary. The 10th District agreed with that finding. That should have been the end of the analysis. Instead, the 10th District created unsupported new legal obligations under the Sixth Amendment that are beyond what the Supreme Court of the United States has set forth.
On that subject, your opposing colleague says that there's no facts supporting voluntary, no facts supporting intelligent, no facts supporting any of the waiver provisions. Well, what facts are there?
On the knowing component, the facts are that the detective read the defendant the Miranda warnings. And on the voluntary component, the facts are that the detectives did not do anything to coerce the defendant into talking. That's what the knowing and voluntary waiver analysis usually focuses on. Does the defendant know his rights, and was he improperly coerced into waiving them? And again, he knew his rights because the detective did read his Miranda warnings. He knew exactly that he had the right to contact his counsel if he wanted. And the detective didn't coerce him into talking. So that's what supports the trial court's finding of a knowing voluntary waiver. And the 10th District agreed, but the 10th District split up the waiver analysis as to say that the Sixth Amendment waiver is somehow different from the Fifth Amendment waiver. But after Monteo, it's not. The judgment should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.